all you out there in Radio Land. You're listening to KPTZ Port Townsend 91.9 FM. For our virtual listeners, we hope your device stays locked onto our website at kptz.org. I'm Marianne McNellis, and this show is called Our Town. The show highlights some of the diverse personalities that make Jefferson County, Washington, so very special. Our Town profiles people from all walks of life, from firefighters to foodies, bus drivers to baristas, and even the lawyers and the ladies who lunch. At this stage, it's almost difficult to remember the pre-COVID Port Townsend. Times have changed. I just heard a guy on the radio saying, go ahead and dust off your masks. COVID cases are going up. Well, that's pretty scary. I'm actually not sure how you dust off a mask. But his point is valid. Cases are up and Jefferson County has not been spared. I'm sure you know someone or maybe even a couple of people who've had it. It almost feels like we've been sleepwalking. Back before the big lockdown in March 2020, KPTZ was poised to move out of our headquarters in the sweet little trailer in the parking lot of Mountain View. Now, 2.5 years later, we're still poised to move to our new headquarters. Will we ever move? I'm getting sort of cynical about the whole thing. I don't know if the materials we need have been delivered. I don't know if we have workmen to install things. I just don't know. But meanwhile, all of us here at KPTZ have been marching on. We've continued to deliver quality shows. So thank you for sticking with us. We're trying our best in these unsteady times, as I'm sure you are. So you know the premise of this show is to help you get to know some of the amazing people here on the peninsula. My guest today, Bob Wheeler, is certainly someone who fits that bill. Bob is the project manager for the new Port Headlock Sewer System. I never thought I could get excited about a new sewer system. But when you think about it, we badly need it. Businesses have extremely limited growth potential when they only have septic tanks, and we're in the midst of an acute housing crisis on the peninsula. A new sewer system will help alleviate that. We'll finally be able to have more multifamily housing units, I hope. So welcome to the show, Bob.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate being here.
So before we get to the Port Headlock sewer system, I think our listeners would like to know a little bit about you. So are you a local guy born and bred on the Olympic Peninsula?
I am not.
Okay, where do you come from?
Well, I come from Huntington, New York. It's on Long Island, about 30 miles from New York City, is where I was born and raised all 18 years through high school.
Okay, and what'd your folks do?
My dad was an engineer. He ran a dye house in Brooklyn, and they dyed clothing is partly what he did as a business. And it was started by my grandfather. My dad took that on over. And then that got liquidated after many successful years. And he was a stockbroker for a while, and then a building and grounds superintendent for the Huntington High School, or the Huntington School District.
And your mom, was she a homemaker?
And my mom was a homemaker. That was sort of traditional in that day and age.
Definitely.
But she was very active in environmental issues and concerns.
So are you an only child?
No, I have two other siblings, a sister, Ren, who's 10 years older than I am, and my brother is deceased now, but he was 7 years older, and we were very close as siblings, even though there was a large
a
age
a gap. Yeah.
Gap.
You were sort of the afterthought.
I was, yep.
Okay. So I always like to ask people about their high school years, not so much about what they thought of themselves, but how do you think the other kids saw you?
I was active in bands and various bands and orchestras. I was active in sports and played several sports in high school. And I think I was a friendly guy. I think most other of the kids there would say that I was an active person that was engaging and trying to grow and learn and, move on to my future, basically.
In your household, was it sort of expected that you'd go on to university?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
No doubts.
And did you get any guidance in that direction?
My dad basically said, you can go to college and take anything as long as it's engineering.
Yeah.
Pretty much. He said, you have to take something that's you're going to come out being able to have a job from your college years.
A practical man.
Yeah. Very practical.
So where'd you decide to go?
I went to University of New Hampshire for both. I got a master's and a bachelor's, obviously, in civil engineering. from University of New Hampshire.
Okay. And did you have some interesting summertime engagements while you were in university?
I did. I had been involved in a group called Student Conservation Association and actually was in the Olympics all the way from Huntington, New York, building a log cabin up the Elwha. Hayes River Station is what it was called. And it was such an amazing experience. You know, I was interested in continuing somehow or another, and it turned out the executive director of Student Conservation Association came to Long Island to run the whole program. So I got selected by him to work at what was called Sagamore Hill National Historic Site, still is called that. It was Teddy Roosevelt's summer White House. And I gave tours of the house itself, which was pretty interesting. Teddy was a very interesting kind of character. Then I gave nature tours too. In the, we had a great Eastern Woods and marshland and
it's still running, right?
It is, yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I've heard about it. I've never been there, but it always seems like a great thing. I mean, Teddy was an interesting character.
He was, for sure.
And I don't think we necessarily know all of his story, but
I think that's true.
Okay, so what was your first full-time job after you got your master's and were...
So I'd gotten my bachelor's, I started on my master's, and I worked a year on getting my coursework done. And a job came up with what was called the Southern Rockingham Regional Planning Commission, which was in southeastern New Hampshire. And it was a program that was part of the Clean Water Act. And we were looking at how should these very rural communities deal with water and water quality issues? Should they put in sewage treatment plants? Would there be other ways for them to approach water quality issues? There is a lot of lakes, small lakes in that particular area. And so it was a great little area, and there was a lot of focus on quality of living and the lakes and the resources they had there, the water resources. So how could they best preserve those with houses right on those lakes, et cetera? And so I worked on a program, and we developed a report for them.
So you were involved with water issues from very early days.
Very early on. And even my studies as a civil engineer, my master's, I really focused on what was now environmental engineering. In that day and age, that was so long ago.
I don't think they had labeled it yet.
They didn't label it. You were basically a civil engineer is how you went into that type of thing.
Uh-huh. But that's what you were doing, really.
Yep.
So this was in New Hampshire, mm-hmm. and you were there for a couple of years?
3 years in that New Hampshire area, yep.
And what was next?
Well, I traveled some in that day and age.
Good.
It was common to travel over in Europe and was bicycling for part of that time, several months up in Scotland, Netherlands, Norway a little bit, and then sort of transitioned to roaming around a lot of different areas of Europe, and then came back, and I'd always had an interest of moving west, so west I came, and I got a job in Pocatello, Idaho, with the what was then called Division of Environment, dealing with the wastewater and water sides of communities and cities.
And didn't you tell me that your brother was also in that region, too?
He was. He had been in the Navy, and I had a rich, eccentric uncle who bought a small ski area in Idaho, and my brother
nice.
Went to manage that. It was kind of fun.
Yeah.
And so he was
it's in, nice to have a rich uncle.
In, it is nice to have a rich uncle, for sure.
Okay. So you were dealing with the city of Boulder, right? You were...
Later, I was. So after 3 years there, I started as an environmental engineering specialist. I didn't have my professional engineer certificate. I managed to get that and became a supervisor of a bunch of engineers that were working with our these various communities mm-hmm. on getting them grant funding from Clean Water Act, which provided a lot of money in that day and age.
Okay,
and
so this is while you're still in Idaho, right?
That's when I'm still in Idaho.
Okay.
So I was there about 3 years, and then this unbelievable opportunity came up in Boulder to be the coordinator of treatment operations for the city of Boulder. And Boulder has a great reputation, and deservedly so. That was just too much to ignore.
I've heard it's a great spot.
It's a really great community. Huh.
And so what were you actually doing?
So I was originally coordinator of treatment operations and became the utilities director for the city. So I dealt with everything related to their water, including all the water rights issues that are very, very big in Colorado. wastewater and wastewater systems, stormwater. We had a little bit of hydroelectric that we put in on our water lines, and so we were producing power. So we had some electric systems too.
Well, the Colorado River is sort of infamous for everyone wanting it. Let's put it that way.
For sure, for sure. Part of our water for Boulder came from a watershed that was actually deeded by, I think it was President Hoover, to the city. It was within Forest Service lands. And so we had this area that the public wasn't allowed in. That was kind of cool because I got to go up there some, at least. But that was only one of our water sources. We had another reservoir on the Front Range up high in the mountains. And so we had that source too. But we had water source from Colorado River that came through a tunnel underneath Rocky Mountain National Park and served that whole area of northeastern Colorado, including Boulder. And we actually added on to that with what was called the Windy Gap Project, which added water to our portfolio.
So is Boulder, I don't really know it, the climate. Is it dry there? Is that... Is water hard to come by, or in fact, is there plenty of water for Boulder?
Well, it just like every place, it's all over. As a matter of fact, there's been some huge wildfires in Boulder since I left, actually. Huh. So it's not always wet. It's fairly dry location, for sure. But there are water resources because the Rockies are right there. I mean, you look up at the Rockies from Boulder, and they get a fair amount of
so you
water.
Get the
and
there's snow
certain,
melt.
There's certain conditions that really bring in some wet conditions, but often is snow. Mm-hmm. And so snow melt is really where water will come from. But there are also a big part of the stormwater side of my job then was dealing with significant floods. There was a flood called the Big Thompson Flood that killed about 132 people from a thunderstorm.
Oh,
that dropped a huge amount of rain. And we had a very similar type of circumstance opportunity in, if you want to call it that, in Boulder also, from the mountains up above us and the river that came through Boulder Creek. So, you know, we had a real chance of flooding occurring in Boulder. So we really dealt with that very progressively.
Okay, and how long were you in Boulder altogether?
So I was there 10 years. Great place.
That's a big chunk of time.
Got to do a lot of outdoor things, a lot of whitewater boating and that type of thing that I enjoyed, and skiing, but cross country and downhill.
And then you decided... Move somewhere else.
I saw this ad in a trade magazine, and I had twin boys at that point in time, one with Down syndrome, and just sort of thought, I don't know that this is my best place to be right now. I'd been there a long time. Looked like my boss was going to be there a long time, so not much opportunity for promotion. And here came this ad in this newsletter that I got saying, public works directors needed in Port Townsend, Washington. And I'd bicycled through here way back when, and I remember it being in the rain shadow and a pretty cool community, even though I didn't spend a lot of time that time. But I thought, So I checked it out. I applied and interviewed and got the job.
Great.
As public works director.
And so when did you start here?
I started in 1990. I think it was July 6th,
okay.
actually. And I worked as public works director through 2000.
Okay. And what would you say are one or two highlights of that era of your...
I'd say the community and the people are really the highlight. It was an amazing time. We were going from the 17th century into... if not the 20th century, at least the 19th century, we're making major improvements. And there's a lot of angst. I mean, there's a lot of, hey, we're fine as we are. Why are we doing all these progressive things? But we had huge things coming down the pike at us, like secondary treatment at our wastewater plant and dealing with our water system, which was unfiltered.
Big issue. I was shocked when I found out that how long the water here had been unfiltered.
Yep.
It only got filtered. What was the year again?
It was just the last few years that it's been filtered. We anticipated we would have to filter at some point in time, but we were able to, through a provision in the law, to avoid filtration, but we had to do lots of things like watershed protection and chlorination to make sure that that little mascot, as I call it, Giardia and Cryptosporidium, wouldn't be predominant in our water system.
But you knew that the feds or the state were going to come after Port Townsend.
For sure. For sure. So, and that happened. But we'd bought the land. So the land where that is land we bought way back then.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so the water did get filtered ultimately. So you left the city in 2000.
Mm-hmm.
any particular reason at that point in time?
There was pretty significant political change in the city at that point in time. And I had been a change agent. So, you know, I had a lot of arrows pointed at me. And I just felt, you know, it's going to be time to make a change. And so I moved on to a firm called Triangle Associates, which is located out of Seattle. I was eventually president of that. And frankly, I could have been a happy public works director the rest of my life, probably. My experiences in that job were just phenomenal. Dealing with air tours over national parks, Glen Canyon Dam advisory committee, facilitated meetings on whether the Macaw tribe could go back to whaling.
Okay.
And a lot of just fascinating projects.
It sounds like it. But how did you get involved with the sewer system, or the sewer system to be?
So in Port Hadlock,
yes.
So our firm had a subcontract with a firm called Tetra Tech, who was working on this project back in 2006 to 2011 or so, when there was a lot of emphasis on this project. And I was involved with the public outreach and public involvement, that type of thing, at that stage of that project. So I had knowledge of it. And I retired, you know, a year or two ago, three years ago, maybe. So I was certainly slowing down in my work with Triangle Associates. And Monty Reinders, the public works director for the county, said, you know, this is going to be a $30 million project. I cannot just do this as, you know, I have a day job to do. I can't do it all that needs to be done. He said, is there any way you could come and help? And I thought about that. It's kind of COVID times. I'm retired. I'm looking forward to new adventures. But I thought I could really help in this project.
Okay. So here's where we need to look at it. We've got a $30 million, which of course we both know is going to be more than $30 million by the time it gets built, sewer project for Port Hadlock. It's been talked about for the last century, it seems like. So it's now looks like it might actually happen, but why do we need it?
Well, first off, the area was declared back in 2000 an urban growth area. And to be declared an urban growth area, so that was working with the city, the county, and deciding with the population projections that they had been given, how do you distribute that population? And part of that was, we're going to distribute part of that population to the Port Hadlock area. And it's partly because that area looks, smells, and tastes like an urban area. There's pretty high density in places within that area. So it was declared an urban growth area. It's very clear that to be able to establish the urban levels of density and zoning in that particular area, you have to have all the urban services that are required. And one of those is a sewer. You can't put in community drain fields. You can't put in septic tanks by the state is saying that. And so, you know, it's right now all rural zoning in that particular area. And if you look at our community, the needs for, and down there, or the whole community, all of East Jefferson County, there's real needs for housing, there's real needs for economic development, and there is significant opportunities for that down in the Port Hadlock area.
Well, the thing that stuck in my mind after our recent discussion was this. If you're zoned rural, a house has to sit on 5 acres of property.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you own 15 acres, for sake of argument, you can only build 3 houses. But if it's zoned urban, it opens it up. How many can you put on?
So you're using a great example. So Habitat for Humanity just recently purchased with, I think it was $1.24 million, about 17 acres of pretty much vacant land down within our phase one area where we are working on getting the sewer in. As you said, right now you could put 3 homes on that. With sewer, they are planning on putting in 120 units. Some of those will be homes. There might be some townhomes. You know, I think they're looking at options in terms of what they'd put in. But you could put in 100. They are planning on putting in 120. You could probably put in 200 even at the urban level of zoning that they would get for that particular area. So that's a phenomenal amount of new housing for not only, I think they're planning not only for people that are below the poverty line or at the poverty line, but for some amount of people that are above that, so that, you know, our teachers, firefighters or police service folks
can afford it. Yeah, and that's an important point, because people tend to associate a habitat house with people, you know, below the poverty line. But they're planning some additional housing. But also, hypothetically, a company that builds apartments could go in, buy land, and put in apartments or condos or whatever.
Sure. And there's other areas there where that can end up happening. There's other housing, Garden Court apartments, for instance. They'd be able to expand the South 7 down on the Methodist Church property, which is senior housing right now. They will be able to expand, because right now they have to reserve their leach field systems, which are big areas, and then they have to have a reserve leach field area. So a lot of property is taken up by, you know, an on-site wastewater system that now will be able to not have to have that, and you'll be able to develop those parcels. And it will be not only housing, but there's a great opportunity for economic development too. A quick example, if you look at QFC, anybody that's tried to park in that parking lot or get in and out of the store, it is very, very crowded. And I know they are very interested in having sewer. Plus, they're running their own little on-site system that's expensive. It was expensive to build, but it's expensive to operate. So I think they are very much, certainly the property owner, is looking forward to this sewer system, because QFC has a great opportunity then to expand or put in a new building that's bigger, sort of upscale, and then create more parking for folks and safer parking in that area. So there's a great example of some of the economic development. But there's a lot of other types of economic development that occurred.
Okay, so existing businesses could expand, but I presume new businesses would look at Port Hadlock with a different eye.
For sure, because you will have that urban levels of zoning. And there's a lot of vacant parcels. If you go out there and roam around, there are a lot of areas where there's not a lot of anything in places, not any structures even. So those will be very much open, but they're not such huge parcels that maybe, you know, I personally don't see that big box stores are necessarily coming in or anything like that. I think it will be more homegrown types of businesses and establishments.
Okay. Well, as we've said, this has been talked about for a long time. Is it really going to happen, and when?
Okay. Well, first, we right now have available to us $25 million, a little more than $25 million from grants. Steve Theringer was very critical in, he's chair of a House committee on the capital budget. So he has gotten $20 million allocation to us, which was not this year, but the year before, for construction. So we have some real significant resources right now, funding. And we are looking at, we've also gotten $2.5 million for Senator Murray. It looks like Representative Kilmer and Senator Cantwell are going to get another $3 million our direction. And then we'll be able to apply for ecology funds too. So we're looking at around $30 million that we're going to have in our coffers. And some of that money we have to spend in certain time frames. So we're looking this fall of actually starting construction on grading of the treatment plant site. And
okay, that's really important for people to hear, that this fall you're going to start construction.
Yeah, later fall, I want to make sure.
Okay, yeah, but still, it gives us an idea that, and that's where the water treatment plant, right?
That's where the wastewater treatment plant will be located, yeah, in that area. That's what we're going to start on first, grading of the treatment plant site.
And you already own the land.
And we own the land, so it's ready to go. It's a gravel pit. It's well sheltered. It's in kind of a pit area. There's a nice forest on the west side and wetland on the other side, which we won't be touching. And we're going to have a rapid infiltration bed located near there that will drain to groundwater with Class A effluent that's going to come out of this treatment type of system that we're using. So kind of the best treatment that the state sort of acknowledges.
Okay, so if things go as you predict, what are you talking about as a timeline? Are we talking a year, 2 years? What are we talking about?
It takes a while to build this, yes. And the pressure sewer system is going to take a while longer probably than the treatment system. I think we have a very good chance of actually opening the doors in 2024, mid to late 2024, or even maybe going into 2025 in the springtime, the first half of that year. I think we have a very good chance of being open for business at that point in time.
Okay. That seems still sort of long, but not really in terms of construction of huge projects like this.
Right. A $30 million project in that time period is doing it pretty fast.
And I believe one of the commitments that you guys have is to get involved local companies in some of the construction work and everything.
Yeah, our hopes are to, we're going to bid this not as one big, huge project where somebody from Seattle is going to have to be bidding on this, because our local contractors wouldn't have the bonding capacity. So our hope is to do smaller bid packages that would allow, or at least open the opportunity for more local construction companies to be able to bid on these various projects and do the work on this. So we're hoping we can keep the money here locally and not have the construction money going to some company that's in Seattle that funding, money goes over there.
I'm sure local people really appreciate that.
It just makes sense from all standpoints, and we recognize that.
So. Yeah, yeah. So this fall, it begins, and mm-hmm. it keeps happening, and you and the rest of the team are going to keep pushing, right?
We are. Yep, we're pushing every day right now. There's permits. There's working with tribes. There's a lot of components to this and putting this all together. We're hoping to submit our 100% design of the treatment plant, the collection system, which is the pressure sewer system, to Ecology in the next few weeks.
Okay, great. Now, we're basically out of time, but I quickly want to mention a few names of people who are key to the project aside from yourself.
Great. All three county commissioners are very actively involved in all kinds of ways, helping on the funding, working with our legislators and others. Auntie Reinders, for sure, is a very key person. Dave Peterson, who's working with me as a part-time person, really helping on this, some of the technical types of things. But there's a lot of other departments, DCD, that, they have a very active role in this. The PUD, because we're working with them on them operating and maintaining this system.
Okay.
Environmental health. So I probably have left somebody out, so I'm sorry.
It's just like your Academy Award speech. You can't name everyone, you know what I mean?
Right.
So, okay, well, Bob, we're basically out of time. You've been listening to Our Town on KPTZ, Port Townsend 91.9. My Marianne McNellis. My guest has been Bob Wheeler, project director for the upcoming Great Port Hadlock Sewer System, which we all really want to see happen. I also want to thank Sunny Flores, editor and producer of Our Town. Many of you don't realize how important the role of an editor is on a show like this. He can edit out our mumbles and stumbles and you-knows, making us sound much more eloquent. In addition to thanking Bob and Sunny, I want to thank you, the listener. Thank you for sticking with us during these troubled times. We're limping through the pandemic together, and hopefully there'll be a light at the end of the tunnel soon. Meanwhile, keep listening to KPTZ, we're a community radio station by and for the people of Jefferson County. Everyone who works here is a volunteer. We give our time because we believe Jefferson County needs a free local voice. We need some more local voices. We need volunteers to make the station stronger. We also need donations to stay afloat. Like all businesses, we have rent, electricity, et cetera, et cetera. We also really want to move to those delightful new quarters at Fort Warden, which will have soundproof booths. So, listener, stay safe, stay healthy. I'm Marianne McNellis, your host of Our Town. I'm signing off for today, but please keep listening to KPTZ for more dynamic, eclectic community radio.
Our Town is an original KPTZ production, created by Marianne McNellis and edited by Sunny Flores.